Hello, welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa with the News Gazette. Today, Wednesday, June the 24th, 2026. Good to be with you today. Hope it's going well for you. Today on the front page is a picture, a beautiful picture of one of our lovely round barns at the University of Illinois, the Leah J. Whiteman round barns, and then a much larger picture of Justin Penrod, an inventory specialist with University of Illinois Facilities and Services, walks through the milking parlor Monday in Barn 3 at the Leah J. Whiteman Round Barns on campus in Urbana. Whiteman, a U of I graduate, left her $10 million estate to the university to sustain the barns. Her friends and relatives, along with representatives of the university, and especially the College of Veterinary Medicine, gathered at the barns that now bear her name Tuesday night to celebrate her legacy. Renovations to the structures focused on exteriors, including roofs and foundations. They're currently underway. At the top of our front page today, an article from the Urbana City Council with the heading, Urbana Civic Center Denied Landmark Status. But MTD could partially preserve it as part of proposed bus transfer station, by Jana Wiersema. The former Urbana Civic Center will not receive local landmark status at this time, the City Council members voting down the proposal Monday night. However, Alderman said that their 4-2 vote doesn't eliminate the possibility of the Civic Center's survival in some form. The landmark application was submitted after the Champaign-Urbana Mass Transit District revealed its hopes of buying the property from the city and building a bus transfer station at the site. At the end of the day, I feel like I would support and would like to see both part of the Civic Center and the terminal come to fruition and together, said Alderman Mary Alice Wu. And I feel like at the moment, the way forward, the end result is unfortunately to not mark this at landmark status today. Alderman Wu, Cherise Hersey, Verdell Jones III, and James Quisenberry voted against landmarking the building, while Chris Evans and Grace Wilkin voted in support. I think there are a lot of opportunities to reuse the building in an adaptive way, Wilkin said. I don't think that means letting it sit there. Additionally, while she agrees that the site is a good option for a needed amenity, she feels that there needs to be more transparency and public input involved in these discussions. MTD Managing Director Carl Gannett told the News Gazette that he was pleased by the council's decision and noted that there is a lot of work to do still. The next step is probably to begin a conversation with the city on the intergovernmental agreement for acquiring that property, he said. And I think that several of the council members that voted no on the historical landmark designation indicated that they still want aspects of this conversation that they just had incorporated into the agreement. So I think it'll be a complex agreement, and I look forward to getting to it. He added that the MTD will likely move forward with applying for a Federal Transit Administration grant for the bus transfer station. The project cost is currently estimated at $32 million, which would put the local match at $6.4 million, according to MTD External Affairs Director Ashley McLaughlin. Local preservation advocate Phyllis Winters Williams submitted the landmark application for the Civic Center, which is located at 108 East Water Street. The Historic Preservation Commission has recommended approval based on a number of criteria, including architectural significance and contributions to the civic and social history of the city of Urbana. Chair Angela Urban wrote in a letter to the City Council that the center is in remarkably good condition for a structure that is approximately 56 years old. More importantly, the Urbana Civic Center was more than a building, she said. It was a civic space open to all members of the community. It provided affordable and inclusive gathering space for residents, organizations, celebrations, and public events. Although the city may have determined that operating the facility was no longer financially sustainable, its closure at the end of 2018 represented a genuine loss to the community. Even prior to Winter Williams' application, there has been debate in recent months over whether or not the MTD can feasibly incorporate the existing Civic Center into its plans rather than demolish the building. Additionally, Historic Preservation Commission members have said that the Transit District has failed to properly engage them in conversations and federal review processes regarding this property. Although MTD officials have disputed these claims, both sides have accused the other of misrepresenting the situation, with Gannett saying that perhaps the one thing they agree on is that there is eroded trust. As for why the MTD is hesitant about the idea of working with the Commission on Adaptive Reuse under a landmark designation, Gannett said that one reason is that the district isn't interested in ceding our authority to build a facility that works for our operations and our customers to an unrelated entity that doesn't know anything about public transit. If the designation had been approved, then the HPC would have the ultimate authority for decisions on altering the building, he said. That would tie our hands from what we're trying to do, create the best facility for our customers, employees, and service. Wu said she's convinced that the community is torn and that people on both sides of the issue are in support of building a bus transfer station. I'm convinced that there has been an erosion of trust between MTD and the Historic Preservation Commission, she said. What I'm not convinced on is I'm not convinced that we can't save any part of the building. However, she feels that the building itself probably can't stand without significant investment. She also noted that since the site is currently owned by the city council would have to approve an intergovernmental agreement in order for the MTD to use the property. This is not the end of the road for either direction, she said. Quisenberry agreed and said that an intergovernmental agreement could provide an opportunity to lay out the city's expectations. Additionally, he remains concerned that a landmark designation could be an obstacle to the project. It may not be insurmountable, but it will certainly take more time and more investment, he said. He added that while the city's capital improvement plan includes funding to demolish the Civic Center, this doesn't have to be done until the MTD is hopefully awarded a federal grant for the project. Or, if the grant application is unsuccessful, the city could revisit landmark status for the site after 1 year passes, Quisenberry suggested. The city's zoning ordinance states that once the council denies a landmark request, a new application on the same property cannot be filed within 12 months of the council's vote. Prior to the council's vote on the Civic Center, aldermen heard three different presentations on the issue. One from Historic Preservation Commission member Catherine Holliday, one from University of Illinois Assistant Professor Joseph Altshuler, and one from Gannett and McLaughlin. Both Holliday and Altshuler argued that adaptive reuse of the site should be seriously considered and can be incorporated into the new bus transfer station. The rehabilitation approach means that you can change the building and make additions, and that the whole point is to pursue an adaptive reuse strategy that would take the existing structure, change it to suit a new purpose, said Holliday, who is a U of I professor of historic preservation and American architectural history and chair of the History Theory and Preservation Program. She continued, rehabilitation is opposed to other approaches to historic preservation. Specifically, is about recognizing that in order to save some buildings, we have to really change them. Altshuler presented some conceptual diagrams for how the existing building could be incorporated into the project in combination with new construction. He said the Civic Center is unique and historically significant, and something that could enhance a future bus station. Gannett told council that he remains fairly convinced that the MTD will lose the ability to accomplish all of our goals if the building remains. However, he said that while historical preservation is not the MTD's priority, the Transit District does want to create something that respects the work done by the Civic Center's architects. Gannett said this could be reflected in the building's design. The MTD also would be open to the idea of preserving part of the building, such as the wooden planks located inside the pyramid-shaped cupolas on the roof. Taking that wood down and restoring it and preserving it and then storing it. There's a cost associated with that, and so we'd have to talk to the city about who's funding that, he said. But we very much would like to be and are willing to have that conversation. And if that activity is undertaken, then I think we'd figure out a way to use that. One of the commissioners also mentioned the need for a qualified architectural historian to be part of the process, which we absolutely agree with given the site, McLaughlin added. And so that would be a requirement of our architectural and engineering team. City Council members also voted Monday to approve the appointment of Stephanie Stewart Cockrell as alderman of Ward 5, filling a vacancy left by the late Chandra Bishop, who resigned in late April and died earlier this month. Stuart Cockrell will represent Ward 5 until April the 6th of 2027, which is the date of the next consolidated election. Dr. Cockrell has demonstrated a deep commitment to serving our community and improving the lives of Urbana residents, said Mayor Deshaun Williams. Her experience gives her a unique understanding of the challenges and opportunities facing our city. I am confident she will be a thoughtful, collaborative, and effective representative for Ward 5, and I look forward to working alongside her as we continue building a stronger Urbana for everyone. Additionally, the council voted to approve the city's fiscal year of 2026-27 budget. Evans made motion to eliminate approximately $455,000 for the police department's community engagement team from the budget, but it failed, as only Evans and Wilkin voted in favor. And there's a small insert with the picture of Keaton Wagler, which has the title, He Loves L.A., and this was heard on News Gazette Radio. Among the guests to weigh in on the NBA draft during Tuesday's show, powered by GTPS Insurance, former Illini Michael Fink says that Keaton Wagler is the newest member of the Los Angeles Clippers, as the former Illini standout guard was number 5 overall pick during Tuesday night's NBA draft at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York. And that will continue that reading later in this broadcast of our News Gazette in the sports section. For now, we will go to the last article on our front page with the heading, Church Arson Admission Nets a Man 10 Years. And this is from the Champaign County Court by Luke Taylor. The Champaign man who pleaded guilty to setting fire to a church sanctuary last year has been sentenced to 10 years in prison for the crime. Dalton Whitlock, 33, admitted to a charge of arson to a place of worship. 10 years was the maximum possible sentence as settled within Whitlock's plea agreement. Pastor John Porter of Mount Calvary Missionary Baptist Church, which had its sanctuary destroyed by the November 19, 2025 fire, testified in Tuesday's sentencing hearing. He said that even with insurance and fundraising efforts, the church cannot afford to rebuild. The blaze caused an estimated $10 million of damage. It has taken everything away from us, he said, requesting the maximum sentence. If you care about other people, there's just certain stuff that you do not do. Champaign County Judge Matt Lee said that Whitlock has not shown that he feels remorse for his actions, but that after his release in a decade, he'll still have time in his life to take a new path. Champaign police and firefighters responded to Mount Calvary at 12:28 p.m. on the day of the incident and saw smoke coming from the roof eaves and windows near the top of the sanctuary. As firefighters got to work, the incident was upgraded to a 2-alarm fire, with crews from both the Champaign and Urbana departments extending hose lines to contain and extinguish it. The entire sanctuary was destroyed in the fire, Porter said. And he believes he would have likely died if he had been in it, in his nearby office as usual. Investigators discovered that the fire was started from multiple points around the building, which led them to believe it wasn't accidental. A campsite with multiple identifiable items was discovered inside a broken window of the church, and Whitlock was seen on surveillance footage with those items. Police also said he was found to have purchased a food item later found at the campsite. Leonard McInnes, associate pastor at Mount Calvary, also testified and requested the maximum possible sentence for Whitlock. "This was a devastating event. Our church has not yet been able to recover," he said. "This," he said, "has left the church family without a home, incurring emotional and spiritual damage along with the physical." McInnes said the church should have been a refuge for youth in the Garden Hills community of Champaign this summer, but it simply isn't available to them due to the damage. Public defender Elizabeth Pollock said that Whitlock has been diagnosed with schizophrenia and asked Porter if that would change how he felt about what punishment the man deserved. Porter said he couldn't answer that. In her argument, she said that the state can't just lock up anyone with a mental illness and that Whitlock was unmedicated at the time of the incident. Despite fears of who would or could have been there, no one was harmed other than a building, Pollock said. Assistant State's Attorney Brooke Hinman said that there was no other way to ensure Whitlock wouldn't offend again, given he had stated he was happy where he was in life, with no future goals. Lee said that despite everything Whitlock has done, he was sure that church family was praying for the man. "You aren't just destroying property, you're destroying community," Lee told Whitlock. "You have a callous indifference toward the harm that you do towards communities." Let's skip over to Section A7 under Opinions and read J. Mark Powell's Holy Cow History article. And in it, there is a picture, a black and white drawing, I would say, of the death of General Andrew Jackson. It's a colored lithograph by J. Bailey of New York, published shortly after the former president's death on June 8th of 1845. And then we have a 1980 black and white engraving of Jackson by Alexander Hay Ritchie, based on a portrait painted by Dennis Malone Carter of Andrew Jackson. And the article is entitled, "The President's Potty Mouth Pet." We've all experienced mortifying moments, like a bad case of hiccups in the middle of a wedding service, or an uncontrollable outburst of the giggles at a high school graduation, situations that spoil a special moment. Such an unfortunate incident occurred 181 years ago this spring, marring a former president's send-off, and the horrified mourners couldn't believe the culprit responsible for it. For decades, Andrew Jackson had seemed indestructible. The Tennessee soldier, planter, and politician wasn't nicknamed Old Hickory for being soft and cuddly. He was fond of bellowing, "By the Eternal," for emphasis. It was considered less blasphemous than the alternative phrase. Yet, if anything, he was even harder-headed and more uncompromising in real life than legend suggests. Consider the duel that nearly killed him. An argument over a horse racing bet led to bad blood between Jackson and a man named Joseph Irwin. Things seriously escalated when Irwin's friend Charles Dickinson jumped in. He and Jackson trash-talked each other in person and in the press. But when Dickinson insulted Jackson's wife, he went too far. In Jackson's eyes, the sun rose and set around wife Rachel. By impugning her, Dickinson signed his own death warrant. When the two met across the state line, and thus out of reach of the long arm of the law, in Kentucky on May 30th, 1806, Jackson got his revenge. Dickinson was known to be a superb shot. To everyone's amazement, Jackson calmly stood in place and allowed his rival to fire first, the bullet hitting him near the heart. Jackson swayed for a moment, but stayed on his feet. Witnesses said Dickinson's face turned white. He knew he was a dead man. Bleeding profusely, although it's believed the full extent of his wound was concealed because he wore a loose-fitting coat, Jackson slowly and deliberately took aim and squeezed the trigger. It stopped at half-cock, under the code Duello, which governed such affairs of honor, Dickinson had to stand there and watch Jackson reload and fire a second time without responding. He subsequently bled to death. Jackson's doctor said the lead ball had lodged too close to his heart to operate, so he carried it in his chest, causing great pain at times for the next 39 years. So when we say he was tough, take our word for it. He was also rough around the edges, a true log cabin guy who was celebrated by his fellow frontiersmen for his social shortcomings. He was more at home with a jug of corn liquor and a plate of country ham than a crystal decanter of French wine and a serving of glazed roast pheasant in the White House. After 2 terms as president, he returned to his cherished Hermitage plantation just outside Nashville, Tennessee, when the end finally came on June 8th of 1845. Jackson was 78 and simply worn out from a long life overflowing with monumental events. A statesman's passing is always major news. This one was marked with all the decorum and dignity the early Victorian era could muster. Nashville's shops and stores were closed, church bells tolled, and guns were fired in tribute for 2 hours. Newspaper accounts reported throngs of people flooding out of the city for the Hermitage on June 10th in a farewell to the former president. It was a warm Tuesday, and many people were packed inside the home. And then it happened. Just before the solemn ceremony began, words suddenly burst forth loudly from a nearby room. Not human words, but those spoken by a bird. And not just way words either, but dirty words. Very dirty words, like Marines undergoing basic training at boot camp. Dirty words. It was Paul, Jackson's pet African gray parrot. William Menifee Normand was 15 at the time and was one of the last survivors of the funeral's attendees. He later wrote, "Before the sermon and while the crowd was gathering, a wicked parrot got excited and commenced swearing so loud and so long as to disturb the people and had to be carried from the house." In another description of the incident, Normand claimed the loud mourning cries coming from Jackson's slaves had set off the bird, triggering perfect gusts of cuss words to the shock and horror of everyone. No one knows for sure who taught Paul this X-rated vocabulary or what happened to him later. However, one thing is certain, the incident would have immensely tickled Old Hickory. By the Eternal! Let's continue on to Section A9 under our communities with an article about the Fair Week that is coming to Central Illinois with a picture of Vermilion County Fair Board Secretary Paige Brown on Tuesday as she stands outside a fair food booth at the grandstands at the fairgrounds located off Route 150 between Danville and Oakwood. Fair Week begins in Vermilion County. Fair season is back, and the News Gazette posed 5 questions to Vermilion County Fair Board Secretary Paige Brown to learn about her longtime involvement in this year's fair, which starts today at the rural Oakwood Fairgrounds and runs through Sunday. How did you first get involved with the fair? Brown said it's been a long time. She said her family started coming to the fair when her daughter, now 31, was 7 and showed animals. I lovingly say my kids grew up out there, and now my grandkids are growing up out here, she said. Brown has 6 grandchildren, and 4 of them will show pigs at the fair this week. She's an Iroquois County native, but her husband, Toby, grew up in Vermilion County. They live in Rossville and are known for owning Lingley Brothers Sweet Corn. 2 of their children also sit on the fair board with Paige. It's a family affair, absolutely, Paige said. She said it's important for her to be involved with the fair because I think county fairs are important. I think county fairs are the way that people may get a little taste of agriculture that they don't necessarily get every day. or they don't think about it. They don't think about where my food comes from or that, you know, my clothes are agriculture. They don't think about stuff like that. So I think it's important that we keep agriculture in the forefront, and it's a good time. County fairs are a good time. What's it like? What does it take to put this on? How does weather affect things? Brown said they have a great big group of volunteers. A lot of people don't realize that on Sunday when the fair ends, on Monday they start planning the next year. It's a year-round thing. It's a lot of work, but it's very rewarding, Brown said. It shows the real community, not only in agriculture, but in our own community, she said. People come together, including board members, sponsors, volunteers, and others who make it possible for them to keep the fair going. Youths come from throughout Vermilion County, of course, to show their animals and for open show entries at the fair, but also can come from neighboring Iroquois and Ford counties and Indiana counties. Brown said they're hoping for beautiful weather, but she keeps in daily contact with the National Weather Service to keep track of any weather events during fair week. They also have a weather radio on the grounds. It was so, so hot last year, she said, which affected attendance. What's new this year? This year's fair theme is Livestock Lineage and Lemon Shakeups. Brown said that with 250th anniversary of the country and the 200th anniversary of Vermilion County this year, they were talking about lineage. There are many who have served on the board, on the fair board for a long time, and that lineage is important to us, something we want to pass on to our own families, she said. A new event is Barnyard Follies. With registration starting at 3 p.m. Saturday, it's a takeoff of the old corporate cup that teams used to compete in at Balloon Classic. But the Follies is livestock-centered fun and games. Bring four or five friends and compete for prizes, Brown said. It's $25 to enter, and teams pick a charity to play for. The winning team and charity in the throw a boot and chuck a cow patty or whatever games each get half of the prize money. Also, Thursday, there's live pro wrestling at the grandstands. In case of rain, it will be in the cattle barn. You try something new every year, Brown said. They also have the Queen Pageant with 14 contestants, Demo Derby, and Junkyard Grand Prix. Animal shows include goat, pig, poultry, and two horse shows. There's also the Petting Zoo and Mary Alice Ag Discovery Zone, food and other vendors and booths. The carnival has approximately 15 rides and also games. It's a $10 gate fee that includes a ride bracelet. Kids ages 5 and under are free to get in the gate and does not include ride bracelet, Brown said. The fees help them provide scholarships, put in new lights this year, and maintain the fairgrounds. And for other support attendance with good weather, can be around $17,000 for the week. It's going to be a good week, Brown said. It's my favorite week of the year. Favorite part of the fair? Brown said it's her pet project, the Pee Wee Showmanship. That's at 6:30 p.m. on Friday. Any kids ages 10 and under can show a pig. The fair board has the event sponsored and the kids get a prize. It's an opportunity for kids that may not have pigs around or whatever to get in the ring and show a pig. There's nothing cuter than a kid and a pig, she said. What's your favorite fair food? Brown said there are so many to choose from of this year's 19 food vendors, though her go-to food is always the popular funnel cake. It's something she can't make at home, and it reminds her of a county fair. Sounds like fun. And that, I said, is happening starting today at the Rural Oakwood Fairgrounds, and runs through Sunday. If you get a chance, go take a visit. Sounds like fun. And I'm going to end this half of our News Gazette, dated June 24th, and I will return with our second half of the News Gazette shortly after this break.